Hello, and welcome to a webinar from MomsFightingAutism.com. I'm your moderator this evening. My name is Chantal Cecile Kira. I'm also the author of several books. The latest one is Autism Life Skills, and I have a new one coming out at the end of March called 41 Things to Know About Autism, and you'll hear about it another time. This evening, the topic is vision and living within the autism spectrum, and my guest is Dr. Carl Hillier. Dr. Carl Hillier graduated from the University of California, San Diego in 1977 with a Bachelor of Arts degree in psychology. He received a Bachelor of Science degree at Pacific University in 1980 and then graduated as a Doctor of Optometry in 1982. He is a fellow in the College of Optometrists in Vision Development. He lectures in very many different places, and I'll let him talk a bit more about his experience. Dr. Hillier, welcome.
Thank you very much, Chantal.
Thank you for agreeing to be on our show tonight, and we're looking forward to hearing a lot about vision and vision therapy and vision processing. Would you like to start by telling us a bit about vision?
Sure. Yeah, I really appreciate the opportunity to share this information. So many people out there really don't have a full understanding of the relationship between vision and human development. And so this is a great opportunity, and I really appreciate that. I'd like to start out by saying that, one of the big myths in our culture is that 20/20 eyesight is perfect vision. And it has to be real clearly understood by, I think, everyone listening and certainly everyone in the clinical community that having 20/20 eyesight is no indication that all is well within the visual system. You know, 20/20 eyesight simply means you can see small things far away, but it really has an inverse relationship to human performance, especially when it comes to academics. Most of what we learn in a classroom setting or in an academic setting has to do with near-point work within arm's reach, with manipulatives and writing and reading and these types of things. And I'm not discounting the importance of clarity in the distance, but what's far more important are these other skills that are involved with vision that include neuromuscular skills and perception and cognition. So I'd like to just give a little bit of an overview of how vision develops and how learning through the visual system is acquired in children and adults, whether you're along the autistic spectrum or not. Yes.
Can you hold on just a second, because I'm getting information from our technology director that we will be able to show some slides.
Okay.
And I need to tell our listeners out there that if you click on the side link on the upper left corner of the screen, then you should be able to see the slides. So I'm going to try to do that on my screen. And there, if you click on the My Slides, you will see the slides showing up. I realize, Dr. Hillier, that you're not hooked into the seminar, but if you can tell me what number screen you would like to have up.
Well, there's three circles there. One's called vision, another speech and language, and movement. Do you see that slide?
Okay, I'm looking right now. Yes, I see that. Vision, speech, language, learning, and movement.
Right. So that's the slide that I'd like to reference now.
Okay.
And so is that up and ready?
Yes, that's up and ready.
Okay. Well, what you see there is this Venn diagram where you have a circle with vision, speech, language, and movement. And these three spheres are absolutely critical for a child to be able to learn efficiently. And this is because movement enables an individual to explore the physical environment. Vision monitors that body's movement through the environment as the individual explores the sensory opportunities available in that environment. And as vision monitors that sensory interaction in the environment, there's a match that occurs between vision and sensory, or vision being one of the primary senses, visual information matching with taction, that is how things feel, how things smell, how things taste, and also how things sound. And then what occurs is an opportunity through that movement through space, as monitored by vision, an opportunity to exchange ideas about that physical environment with others through the use of speech and language. And so the combination of speech and language development, the ability to have a repertoire of movement skills, and vision being able to monitor that movement and direct the intelligent movement of the body through that space nurtures the opportunity to engage in a linguistic exchange between other people about the physical experiences that you've had through the sensory interaction with the world that you're exploring. So learning emerges out of this interaction between vision, the movement of the body through space as it engages in its sensory interaction in that space, and then ultimately developing the speech and language opportunity to share with others what's been seen. On the next slide, there's just a single dot there, and it's a single dot that says vision. Do you see that there?
Okay. Yes.
Okay. And that's basically to let you know that we're going to go into now talking about the purpose of vision. So the next slide really talks about vision's purpose. And if you look at it in this way, you see those three slides there, those three dots below.
Okay.
Okay. It says, to know what and where things are. So this is the main purpose of having a visual system, is to know what and where things are around you. And this enables then that next circle to come into play, and that is to be confident in the visual space that you're inside of. You know, one of the main reasons of having a visual system is to be safe in the physical environment that you're in. And once the visual system has confirmed for the individual that they're safe, that is, they know when and where things are happening around them, then the third sphere can arise, and that is to derive meaning from the environment. But you can't do that unless you're safe or you feel confident in the space that you're in. Once you're feeling confident in the space that you're in, then your mind is free to consider more abstract concepts such as language or visual memory or visual imagery and these types of things. But it all begins with the visual ability to assess the space around you, to know what and where things are relative to your body in that situation. Then you develop confidence in moving through that space, knowing that you're not going to be injured or threatened or frightened with all that's around you. And once your mind has understood that that's secure, then your mind is free to consider these other things, other cognitive activities like written language, spoken language, things of that nature. Now the next line, it has a bubble on top that says vision, and there's five little circles under there. Two of them are blue and three of them are green. And the first two circles are what most individuals are evaluated for. That is, whether or not you have 20/20 eyesight and whether or not your eyes are healthy. And these are quite important, obviously, but they're not nearly as important as the subsequent three areas there. The muscles, that is the neuromuscular coordination of the eyes, visual perception and visual cognition. So the first two on the next slide, you can see that I've highlighted the 20/20 bubble there. It's blue and it says 20/20. And that simply means that you can see small things far away, and that's all there is to it. So if you go to your pediatrician or you go to your eye doctor and what they say is that you see 20/20, your eyes are perfect, you're really only getting a very, very small understanding of what vision's capacity really is. The next slide talks about eye health, and certainly that's important. We're looking for cataracts, glaucoma, retinal detachments, things of that nature, and you certainly want to have good eye health. But these are very, very small, relatively insignificant, and if you think of it, you know, if your eye health is relatively insignificant when it comes to learning, that's quite a statement. But
Dr. Hillier, it's so interesting because it's true. That's all you hear about. You know, whenever you take your children to get checked up or even at school when they consider eyesight, all they're concerned about is 20/20 and the health.
That's right. And that's a big myth in our culture that needs to be dispelled because children are being misunderstood in a major way all the time, all throughout our country, actually all throughout the world, in regards to this process. Because 2/3 of all the nerves that enter our brains originate from the eyes. That is, there's 3 million nerves that come into the brain. 2 million originate from the eyes themselves. And the 20/20 eyesight aspect of this and the eye health aspect of this are minuscule compared to these other areas that I'll be talking about that affect behavior in a major way. So, yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. It's a myth that has to be dispelled. And as a matter of fact, you should get a little upset if somebody says to you, hey, your child's eyes are healthy, they see clearly, and so let's now talk about some other things that might be affecting your child's behavior.
Well, I am myself upset because my son Jeremy, 21, as you know, you've been treating him over the past year. No one had ever spoken to me about his vision, and I had heard about vision processing challenges, and I had considered perhaps as late as 3 years ago to think about vision therapy for Jeremy. But even before that, nobody had ever mentioned it.
Right.
In relation to someone like my son, and it is, as you well know, and later on I'll talk about it a little bit, about how much the vision therapy and the other things that you and the other therapists in your office have done has just been amazing, and it's been a big change for Jeremy, not just in how he processes, but also in his behavior.
Yeah, it's an amazing system. It's our dominant system. All human beings, and all mammals for that matter, vision is the dominant sensory system for survival. It's our dominant sensory system for deriving meaning from the environment. And it's our dominant sensory system that links to linguistic skills and other forms of cognition that enables us to be who we are as human beings. And so I had a patient this morning, a 12-year-old boy along the autistic spectrum, whose mother was just blown away by the new information she gathered, how her son responded to the yoked prisms that I prescribed. I mean, this boy was completely unable to stack a stack of 10 inch cubes ever in his life. We put on some yoked prisms that stabilized his visual field, that provided an opportunity to have spatial organization, and he was stacking inch cubes up to 15 that he'd never been able to do before. And it was simply because he had an organized visual spatial world inside of which he could operate. And so it is quite frustrating. So don't allow anyone to say to you that your child has 20/20 eyesight, the eyes are healthy, and so everything's okay visually. Because what they have not investigated yet are the neuromuscular skills, and that's on the next slide here, and you might see it. The neuromuscular skills, the visual perceptual skills, and the cognitive skills. Now, the visual muscular skills involve focusing, that is the ability to cause things to be clear close up. Tracking, that is the ability to scan your visual environment in an effective way. And then eye teaming, that's the ability to see a three-dimensional view of the world, to have there be a three-dimensional construct inside of which you are moving your body. And without those three things, you'll be very insecure in the space that surrounds you. And so anyone that's going to look at the visual skills necessary for child development or academic development or athletic development for that matter needs to evaluate the ability, the skill, and the endurance of all of these things that I'm talking about. And you can imagine this can't take place in a 15 or 20-minute examination. You know, this takes a 2 or 3 hour evaluation, which is what your children deserve to have done. Now, on the next slide, I've highlighted perception. And in that slide, there's lots of different little bubbles below there. And so if you look at each one of them, you can see that some of them involve, I'm just checking my slides here, but some of them involve visual figure ground, visual form constancy, visual closure, visual discrimination, spatial relations, size constancy, form constancy, visual auditory integration, visual motor integration. And these are absolutely crucial if you're going to be successful academically. On the next slide, in terms of visual cognition, you have the areas of visual memory, visual attention, visual imagery, visual thinking, and being able to contend with visual language symbols. So I'll pause there, Chantal, if you have any questions or comments in regards to that.
Well, I just wanted to ask you, because it's not really related to something that you've said, but it's a clear thing that needs to be mentioned. how do you find the right type of person to do the right type of exam for your child?
Well,
because,
for example,
especially when you're working with someone with autism, as you know, it's not as easy to do an assessment as it is with someone who's just going to sit and respond to everything.
Right, right. Well, yeah, as you know, an examination of a child along the spectrum doesn't necessarily involve them sitting in the chair, the exam chair, and
right.
letters off a chart. We follow the child around in the environment that they might naturally engage in. So this takes a certain amount of skill and experience. And the type of individual, the type of doctor that you'd want to see is typically one that's a fellow in the College of Optometrists and Vision Development. And you can go to covd.org, and there's a doctor locator there on that website that'll enable you to find somebody that is likely to do this type of examination. But I would, after you find somebody in your area that's a fellow in the College of Optometrists and Vision Development, I would call the office and interview them. You know, talk to the receptionist and, you know, learn a little bit about to what extent does that doctor work with those along the autistic spectrum. And if you get a chance, you can even interview the doctor on the phone a little bit too, because you're going to want to be comfortable and know that when you go, you're going to get the information that you need. And I think it's important also to get a written report. There's just too much information, as you can see, of just the short time that I've reviewed these different visual skills. There's too much information to remember in a short, brief conference after the examination, especially when the child's there. It's very hard to concentrate and to gather all the information. So I think it's really important to get a nice written report and then meet at a later time to discuss the ramifications of the findings, what different therapeutic interventions are available, and what might be the effect of these different interventions. So it's good to interview that office first. But I think the first step is to go to the College of Optometrists and Vision Development and find a fellow that's in that organization to evaluate your child.
That's very helpful. Now, did you want to continue down with the slides at all, or did you want to start taking questions from what people have sent in?
Well, I mean, I think we can stop with the slides, but I think it's very important just to realize, those listening, that the visual skills necessary for learning go far beyond the ability to see clearly, that all these other visual skills are as important. And some of the most typical interventions that you might be offered after an examination such as this, which are just happen to be the most typical interventions that are the most successful for children along the spectrum, have to do with yoked prisms, that's Y-O-K-E-D, prisms that help individuals reestablish spatial confidence with where they are in the environment that they're in. The other intervention might be a tint in their glasses that helps stabilize the volume or the intensity of the light coming in. And then finally, vision therapy, which you mentioned before, and that is the ability to integrate visual information with the other sensory systems to enable there to be a more coherent visual understanding of the environment around them. So I think this would be a good time to take questions.
Okay. So here's a question from Rose in Corning, Arkansas. How does vision therapy work? And then her second question afterwards is, and how can we get our school to do this?
Okay. How does vision therapy work? Well, vision therapy is a program of directed activities that are designed to meet what the child's current skill level is and then slowly expand their repertoire of abilities in a wide variety of different areas. So there's visual motor skills, for example, the ability for the child to visually engage in motoric activities, that is visually guided movement or the intelligent movement of the body, whether it be on a gross motor level and then escalating to a fine motor level. So we have to first establish a foundation of the primitive reflexes within the body and the body's ability to contend with gravity via the vestibular system. So as you might have gathered from what I just said, we work in concert with occupational therapists quite a bit who have an understanding of this process of vestibular development and sensory integration. So we have to establish that first. So we very rarely work independently of other professionals, especially those involved with occupational therapy and speech and language. So vision therapy capitalizes on the hopefully pre-established ability for a child to contend with gravity and to develop bilateral coordination of the body. But then we get into the visually guided aspect of that. And we want to make sure that the child has the ability to visually plan the movement of their body and to have it go through a sequence of activities that become, I guess you could say, culturally meaningful. That is, construction of objects, using a pencil, graphomotor skills, handwriting, and things of that nature. So we start with a visually guided movement of the body. And through that exploration, then we will slowly integrate auditory and other visual imagery tasks as well. So they can begin to use auditory, whether it be linguistic or non-linguistic, correlates to the information that they're seeing, and to also guide the movement of their body based on auditory information, whether it be from a metronome or through vocal communication. We have to integrate the auditory system as well. And then we move on to, as they secure themselves or they have developed security in that kind of vocal and visual and manipulative environment, we would then move into more cognitive-based kinds of things like visual imagery and visual memory. But we meet the child where they are and then slowly nurture the development so that they're 80 to 100% successful in the activities that they do. If you go into a vision therapy office, it looks very much like almost like an occupational therapy gym, because we do have balance boards and walking rails and physio balls, T-stools and things of that nature. But that's not our main emphasis, because we depend on occupational therapists to do that kind of work. But we dovetail that into the visually guided activities.
And I think it's important to explain to people that there's no miracle here, and it is work. So in other words, the child needs to be doing homework at home as well.
Right. Well, I don't like to call it homework if I can help it, because they might have enough of that already. But we give them visual activities to do that hopefully are interesting.
I mean, they're fun.
I mean, like we did with Jeremy, you know, we give them balance boards and balls hanging from the ceiling, and we have them work with tracking tubes and matrix activities and all kinds of manipulatives. And it is fun because there's an interaction between the parent and the child, and there's goals that are reachable. And so when they achieve a certain level, there's satisfaction, and we make sure that there's satisfaction. And we constantly, what we call, load the system. So as an individual develops competency in a certain area, let's say they have competency in being able to understand figure ground more easily, so they can detect important features amongst an otherwise complex array of irrelevant features. And as they become more competent with that, we slowly add more irrelevant features to see if they can still detect the target that we want them to, and they feel success with that, and they realize the benefit of it, and they actually can start to apply that in their daily lives more easily that way as well. So we're constantly loading the system with either auditory or vestibular or tactual or visual stimuli to simulate or to enable them to contend with real life when they get away from the clinic. Because they can be as successful as they want to be or can be in the clinic or at home, but if it doesn't transfer into their social or academic or athletic environment, it's really not very fulfilling.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you want to address the question of how you managed to get the school to help you in this arena?
Yes, I can address that as well. It is challenging. Many of the children that we see come into the office because it's advocacy driven, and but there are many school districts, fortunately in California here, who really understand the critical relationship between vision and behavior, and they will send many of their children to a vision therapy doctor, an optometrist that does the vision therapy, to get an assessment. I think that's really says a lot for those school districts that do that. I really find that to be quite unique. How to get it into the schools, if that was the question, how to get an assessment into the schools or vision therapy into the schools, the vision therapy, as designed by the developmental optometrist, is often it's often not done in the schools by the optometrist, but it's through a discussion with the occupational therapist and the aides in the classroom, there are activities that are given to be done throughout the day as monitored or given by aides and or occupational therapists. So what's clinically designed in the optometrist's office is conveyed to those that surround the child in the classroom, and it should be hopefully a seamless transition and or a consistent opportunity to engage in activities in the school. But the optometrist typically doesn't go to the school, do the evaluations there, nor does he go to the school or she go to the school and provide activities at the school. But it's really done through educating those that surround the child in the school.
Okay, here's a question from IJR in San Diego. My son has a hard time finding the main idea in complicated pictures. I found that, in my opinion, he has hard time to identify angles. In his drawings, he always rounds the edges. Is this familiar or normal?
It's certainly familiar, and it's certainly common, you know, with children, whether they are along the spectrum or not. But this is often due to a lack of previous experience with engaging in manipulatives that are matched with vision. And as you know, it's frequent that individuals won't be looking at what their hands are manipulating in a meaningful way. So, for example, if a child is manipulating a structure of that's involved, that has angles and blocks of various sizes and shapes, and they're manipulating that structure, and they're maybe building a structure, looking at the structure, feeling the structure, having vocal or verbal labels associated with those structures, like let's put the diamond on top of the square, now let's rotate the diamond so it looks like a rooftop. Now can you feel the tip of the rooftop and feel how sharp the rooftop is? Now if you go down to the edge of the rooftop, can you feel how it's sharper along the bottom edge of the rooftop? Now let's put the rooftop down and put a different rooftop on and see how this rooftop now is more rounded. Can you feel the rounded aspect of the rooftop? In other words, what I'm saying here is that if we can match the sensory systems of touch, movement, proprioception, vision, and language, if those can be coherent and reliable for the child, then when they simply go to a visual display that doesn't have all those other tactual opportunities, then the visual display becomes more meaningful in terms of recognizing angles, figure ground, and these types of things. So I think what we do in vision therapy is bring children back into the manipulative phase where they're actually watching the manipulation and engaging in the linguistic correlates that surround those shapes. And then we slowly bridge the gap into a more abstract, that is, non-tactual opportunity, that is, looking at a picture and seeing the same things that you might be able to do if it was three-dimensional.
Right. Okay, Renee in Rochester, New York. Her son, she writes, my son is on the spectrum and enjoys looking at things in a straight line out of the corner of his eye. It is also calming to him when he is anxious. Is there anything you can do to correct this peripheral vision, and do you think I should have his eyes looked at?
Well, I think it's always a good idea to have the visual system looked at. Now, so I always try to, I'm kind of very picky on the words that I use because I don't want there to be any misunderstanding. Looking at the eyes is one thing, and that's checking the health of the tissue of the eyes and looking at the eye's ability to discriminate small things far away. That's 20/20. But if you look at the visual system, so I'd reword that and say, yes, I think you should have the visual system evaluated in a broad way, like I had mentioned before, the neuromuscular skills, the visual perceptual skills, and the visual cognitive skills, because this gives you an opportunity to understand your child's behavior more. You want to understand everything about your child's behavior, and one of the best ways to do that is to investigate that huge volume of information that arrives into the brain from the eyes. That is, two-thirds of all the nerves that come into the eyes originate, or into the brain, originate from the eyes. So having a baseline understanding of that, I think, is crucial. Now, and for any child, whether they're along the spectrum or not, because vision is such a dominant aspect of our ability to learn and our ability to develop. But that aside, when your son looks down the corner of the eye, out of his eyes and he looks down a straight line. I think what's going on there, and a lot of people would agree, and maybe some people might disagree, but what I think this is doing for them is it's stabilizing their visual environment. It's giving them an edge or a boundary or a reference point from which they can feel oriented. Okay, so we all want to feel oriented in space. And when you look down the edge of your, when you look out of the corner of your eye, you're looking sideways. You can see the bridge of your nose. You can kind of see your cheek. You have a physical structure from which to then be looking out of. When your eyes are looking straight ahead, there's kind of a free form opportunity to explore the world, which might be a little bit too overwhelming if it's not a structured space world to be inside of. But when you look down the corner of your eye and you're looking edgewise, you have this, your eyes can't move any further. You've got kind of an edge over the cross, the bridge of your nose. And if you're looking down a line, you know that that line has continuity. It's stable, it's oriented, and it's probably not moving. And so that gives you some sense of stability. Now, having said that, a lot of individuals will look out of the corner of their eye and shake something, and they will stim. It's called stimming, as you well know, and they might shake something to have that moving information, but they're shaking it, and they're moving it, and they know that they are in charge of that movement. And that also can, I think, be stabilizing to them in terms of getting a sense of where they are, where they're oriented.
Very interesting. Here's a question, kind of a long one to explain, from reader Ryan in Calabasas, California. Hello, Dr. Hilliard. Thank you for taking the time to address families dealing with autism. I am a 49-year-old high-functioning autistic with visual disturbances. Patterned carpets, striped shirts, and houndstooth patterns strobe on me so I lose my balance, almost hallucinate. My former employer thought I was coming to work drunk, but the carpet pattern made me swagger, and I was laid off. Nobody believed that I had visual disturbances. Patterns also trigger migraines. I typically get 2 severe migraines per week. My 15-year-old daughter is high-functioning Asperger's who does not leave the house due to social fears, and I now homeschool her. I am concerned that she also has these visual issues, but she has passed all eye exams. I also have passed eye exams. Is there a standard test for these visual disturbances that I can administer? Thank you for your response.
Yeah, you're not alone, you know, in experiencing those things. And that is a real devastating situation. What we refer to these situation of the patterns is that these are either temporal patterns or spatial patterns. Okay, so there's a spatial pattern, is the carpeting that you were talking about, these grid patterns on wallpapers, any kind of repetitive pattern can, in fact, and it's been proven to induce seizures in people that are prone to that. So these spatial patterns can actually induce migraine, which is a form of seizure, or a petit mal seizure, or even a grand mal seizure. These are visually induced myoclonic seizures or visually induced absent seizures that significantly interfere with people's quality of life, obviously. And the other type of pattern you're talking about is a temporal pattern. So this temporal pattern is a flickering of light, driving along a road and going past a whole bunch of tall juniper trees that might cast shadows, flickering shadows across your field of view. Flickering fluorescent lights are horrible for most people in this situation, and it's a very, very tough thing to contend with. So this is sometimes called cortical hypersensitivity to light. And there's a test called the bihemispheric dissonance test, which can enable clinicians to know whether or not there is this pattern set up in the brain based on either spatial patterns or temporal patterns, spatial frequencies or temporal frequencies. And so this bihemispheric dissonance test is, and you won't want to look at this, that the person that sent in this question will not want to look at this pattern. It's a pattern of horizontal stripes, about a quarter inch black and white stripes laterally, left and right, on a page that's about 4 by 6 inches. If you look in the center of that page, and you want to look away real quick, then you probably are susceptible to this cortical hypersensitivity situation. And now the solution to that is oftentimes, but not always. Oh, by the way, this is associated with the Erlin syndrome. There's an Erlin syndrome that you might have heard about that is similar to this situation you're talking about. And it's really called the Erlin-Mears syndrome, because Mears also co-discovered the situation whereby there's visual stress that's induced by print vibrating on the page, for example. What this individual is experiencing, or the questioner is asking about, visual patterns, which when you look at a book, if you look at a book, there's rows and rows of lines. And these lines are also, when your eyes move across these patterns, can set up a seizure situation, a headache situation. And this is oftentimes when people can't read very effectively. They have the Erlin-Mears syndrome. Now, the solution to that for many people, as you might recall from the Erlin syndrome or the scotopic sensitivity syndrome, is a specific tint. Now, there's something called a colorimeter, which is a scientific approach to this that scans all the visual hues available in the spectrum of all the different saturations and all the different attenuations. And you can systematically define whether or not an individual has this sensitivity that can be resolved with wearing a specific color tint. Okay, so a lot of individuals along the spectrum have very similar situations with headache, migraine, seizures, and
right.
And so there's a correlation there, and if you wear a specific tint, it can often completely eliminate these headaches, this being a victim of these patterns, whether they be temporal patterns or spatial patterns, and it can significantly minimize the impact of those situation. So that's a really good question. There are clinical solutions out there. I would definitely look into somebody that works with colorimetry. You can Google Arnold Wilkins, W-I-L-K-I-N-S, who pioneered the systematic scientific investigation of this particular syndrome that the questioner is asking about.
Wow, that's great information. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Here's one. I know you'll like this question. It's from Chris W. in Boyne City, Michigan. What is the best approach to getting an audience with the school to explain vision-related learning problems to teachers? So in other words, doing some training in or awareness about what you've been talking to us about here to teachers in the school.
Well, I know that the College of Optometrists and Vision Development has a speakers bureau, and they... You know, they can send people out to the local community to educate those that are interested. And usually if it's parent-driven, then a PTA, an interested PTA that would like to invite a speaker, I'm sure that through the College of Optometrists and Vision Development, they could find somebody easily through that method. Also, Parents Active for Vision Education, PAVE, is a grassroots organization of parents that are committed to having schools all over the country, public, private, whatever, to have a better understanding of vision and learning. And their website is PAVEVISION.org. That's pavevision.org. An excellent resource for any parents or educators that want to learn more about vision and learning, to acquire a whole body of scientific literature that confirms the validity and the efficacy and the importance of having children's vision evaluated. So that would be another good group.
Great.
Yeah.
This is a question from Jennifer in Orlando, Florida. I have a 13-year-old child that has extreme issues with writing and reading. Today he is currently diagnosed as being high-functioning. I've suspected for years his issues stem from visual issues. Visual processing skills are extremely low with regards to testing done by the public school system. I've been unable to locate visual therapy at affordable prices in this area. Currently, there has been only one therapist located in this area, and insurance company does not acknowledge visual therapy as a valid therapy. Can you recommend a website or a program a parent can purchase themselves to administer to their own children?
Well, there's lots going on there. I think there's a misconception about insurance companies saying that it's not a valid therapy, because it is a valid therapy, and insurance companies do cover it in California and other states in the country. Certainly, insurance companies wouldn't pay for it if it were experimental or not valid. In the state of California, for example, vision therapy is written into state law. So if a child has an IEP and it was determined that a child has a visual processing dysfunction and that it could be treated through vision therapy, then it's in state law that the state of California and the local school districts would pay for it. So in no way is it not a valid therapy or experimental. That's just a misnomer. So it does cost money, of course, and there are some insurance companies that will help cover it, but like all insurance companies, they don't cover everything. So they do, you know, insurance companies are there to make a profit, and that's fine, but they also want to preserve their profits by not covering all variety of therapies. So sometimes vision therapy is one of those things. In terms of a program that might be more efficient, or I shouldn't say more efficient, but rather maybe affordable to those that, for whatever reason, can't afford, say, a private office doing the vision therapy, there is a program that's available that many people have found helpful. It's called Catalyst Vision, and catalystvision.org, I think it is. And it's not a clinical program. It's an educational program that helps people understand the role that vision plays in learning, and they do have a variety of activities that are available for children to engage in to help develop their visual abilities, but it's not based on solving a diagnosed visual dysfunction. Okay, it's just a generalized program of developing visual abilities, so it wouldn't be something that you would do because your child's been diagnosed with, say, convergence insufficiency. You know, a medical diagnosis that optometrists come up with in an examination is typically covered by a major medical insurance company or through private pay. So this Catalyst program isn't designed to remediate diagnosed visual dysfunctions that were determined by a clinician. But it is something that has been helpful for lots of parents because they have no other place to go. And so that's called catalystvision.org. So that might be a resource. But there are also other resources. Lions Clubs oftentimes will fund clinical treatment programs for children. Many clinical offices will offer scholarships for children who have difficulty, or there might be a sliding scale or some kind of extended payment plan.
Great. That's really helpful. Here's a question from Alicia in New Ringgold, Pennsylvania. What signs or symptoms of visual impairment should professionals, i.e. therapists, look for when treating younger kids 0 to 3 years old? So in other words, how could somebody possibly notice that they're having symptoms of visual processing?
Well, I think...
You're dealing with really young kids.
Sure, yes. And these young kids certainly aren't going to vocalize that they have an issue. Visual difficulties are hidden disabilities because you can't see what the child's seeing unless there's a blatant eye turn. So, for example, if a child has an eye that's blatantly turning in or out, that's a clear indication that you need to have their visual system evaluated. It's difficult because if a child was stuttering or they weren't speaking, certainly you'd bring them to a speech and language pathologist because the child is basically voicing the need for that. But from a visual perspective, you need to observe their behavior. And there's three behaviors that you can watch in a child. And the most obvious one is avoidance. They're avoiding doing things that other children have no problem engaging in. That would be the first behavior. The second behavior would be for them to have to take a lot longer to do something that's visual in nature than other children would have to take. And then the third behavior, which is more difficult to identify, but that's when they have physical symptoms like headache or eye pain, which could result in eye rubbing, or their eyes turning red. These kind of behaviors are indications that they're having physical symptoms like a headache or eye pain or maybe even double vision or blurred vision. So the three symptoms basically are avoidance, a lack of doing things in an efficient manner or doing things as quickly as other children. And then the third, which is most challenging, I think, is to glean whether or not they're having any physical symptoms. They're crying, they're cranky whenever they're engaging in a particular activity, but not in other activities. So visual activities that involve manual manipulation of things primarily.
I want to mention something. This is not for the very young ones. These are more like for school age.
Uh-huh.
But for one reason why we never thought that my son had vision processing problems is because, and this is what everyone would always tell me at school, and I noticed it at home, because he would be always staring intently at books and at pages in books. And so everyone said, well, he must be able to see because he's using his eyes. And it's really interesting because Jeremy is, for the listeners here who haven't heard me before, aren't familiar with my son, nonverbal. Well, he has a little language, but not enough to express what he's feeling or perhaps what he's seeing, but he now can spell out by pointing to a letterboard and to a keyboard. And he now, over the last few years, has been explaining about what he saw and why he did what he did when he was little. And he explains a lot of things about his hearing, and also one thing that he mentioned about his visual is that he could not see letters, but he saw the little dots and the lines of ink that made up the letters. And so he was looking at the little tiny detail instead of looking at the whole. And I actually did some things with him without realizing what I was doing or why it was that it was working. But I did some things with him that helped him to actually see the letters and then to notice, a few letters together that they were words, and then he identified these patterns. But it's really only now that he's being able to explain to us what he sees, and he actually talked about what it was like once he put on the prism glasses that Dr. Hillier gave him, and he said it was as if he was blind before and he was seeing the world for the first time. And so you can't always look at someone by just saying, well, he's so looking intently at that book that he must be seeing it. That's two different things.
That's right.
Right.
That's exactly right. And Jeremy is very, very articulate when he expresses himself with written language and describing these things. And it was just wonderful to hear, to read what he had said about that, because it's true. We as human beings look for patterns. We are pattern recognition people. And when you look at patterns, when you look at anything, that's the first thing you look for is patterns, and that's what he was doing. He was looking at the tiny patterns that made up the letters, that made up the words, but he wasn't looking at the word pattern. He was looking at the little lines that made up the pattern. And he mentioned the same thing in regards to looking at pictures. He could see all the little patterns inside of a picture, but he didn't see the whole gestalt meaning of the picture or the portrait. And so we don't know what they're looking at. They can watch TV, they can look at a book, and all variety of things, but you don't know what they're processing until you do some testing to find out what it might be that they're processing, and to provide a different kind of visual input, that is through the prisms or through tinted lenses, to then see their behavior change. And it's through that changed behavior that they start manifesting different, they start engaging in different kinds of activities that help you realize, oh, they didn't see it before. And we're not talking, again, 2020, they didn't see the intention of what was offered before.
But it is really amazing, and I like to give the example of Jeremy. He talks about how looking at a person was looking at a portrait of someone painted by Pablo Picasso, for those who are familiar with Picasso, when, you know, he's very modern and cubist, and so, you know, you see an eye on one end and a nose somewhere else. It's not a whole face.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
He actually now says that, and I'm reading from a paper that he's written here, that before vision therapy, I could only see fragments instead of seeing objects as a whole. It was hard to understand how things were forming a whole. He says, vision therapy trained my eyes to get the whole picture of everything I see. Instead of focusing on the detail first in the whole, now I focus on the whole first and then the detail. The vision therapy exercises helped because they began to change very noticeably how I looked at the world. I started seeing things that I wouldn't really look at before, like images on a frame or the smile on my mom's face, since before I could only see parts of a face without being able to recognize emotion. Vision therapy exercises also made me realize what the signs on the streets really were and what they meant. Before, I would only notice the bright colors. Now I know to read the signs and I understand them. So that's pretty amazing.
That is just amazing. And he says so much there. And in regards to facial recognition and the understanding of emotional intent, mm-hmm. you can't do that if you can't see the structure of a face in an organized way. So you can't see the pattern of emotional intent or communication intention, you know. And now he's starting to get that. And, you know, the other day when we were working with Jeremy, he was just having a great time. And it was, and this was even without his glasses on, because he's starting to derive that his knowledge on his own now. And I'm hoping that eventually he might not need the glasses, you know, for extended periods of time. It'll become a part of who he is, because he has this segue into understanding and seeing things as they are, rather than the little bits and pieces that are trying to construct what they are, and he never gets that construction. So yeah, it's just wonderful how he describes that. Yeah.
It's interesting too how the he has prisms with glasses now. I mean, with tints. But the funny thing is that he has a hard time wearing them. Now, if you're someone who doesn't know Jeremy or doesn't understand a lot about autism, you think, oh, well, that kid doesn't really want those glasses because he's constantly trying to take them off. But he very clearly states that it's like a constant struggle to keep the glasses on because he's not used to wearing something on his face. It's that sensory issue that he has. And so it's a struggle because he wants the glasses on, but he has a hard time getting used to the feel of it on his face and his head.
Right. And sometimes it's such a novel experience to see such overwhelming structure and clarity to what's available in your environment that sometimes after a while you just have to stop and regroup and be away from it, just like we all might have to in certain situations. Like going to a 3D movie, for example, you know, some of it's sometimes so overwhelming that some people just want to take a break from it because it's too vivid and it's too dynamic. And it's kind of like that. It's like going from always watching a 2D movie, then seeing Avatar and seeing the incredible depth and vividness of the perspective and the movement. That's kind of like what it is, I think, for a lot of individuals along the spectrum who ultimately have an opportunity to try these lenses on and see what the differences are.
Yeah, and I'm going to read one more thing from Jeremy because I think it really describes everything that you've said about how important the vision is to life and to perception and to learning. Jeremy said, "I think the glasses are a great component to my eyes and my brain because my eyes are like a door for my brain to understand and process the world around me."
Yeah.
And that's exactly it.
Yeah. It is a doorway in a sense because now things are open to him and he can see what's inside, what we've all been living in. He now has a glimpse of that and he's starting to live into that.
Yeah. So it's really, really amazing.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go back to some questions here because we have so many. Okay. You know, this is an interesting question. So perhaps you might want to, because I didn't really explain when I introduced you. Rihanna from Hollywood would like to know what your credentials are when it comes to autism.
Oh, okay. I have no specific credentials in regards to autism per se. I'm a clinician, I'm a licensed optometrist, and I'm a fellow in the College of Optometrists and Vision Development. And in my training as a doctor of optometry, we are trained to work with all variety of individuals, whether or not they have a brain injury, if they have developmental delays, all variety of genetic syndromes. So it's just part of our training as a clinician to deal with all variety of individuals of different populations. I don't have any particular training, say, in DAN protocol or anything like that, which I think a lot of clinicians do, and I think it's very worthwhile to do that. But it's just not a part of what I've done in the pursuit of the activities that I'm doing with individuals along the spectrum.
I have to say, though, that Dr. Hillier, you have a special touch. I've never seen anybody so calming and so relaxed. Really, seriously, you're the first person who's ever gotten so much out of my son on a first meeting when it comes to an assessment. So it really doesn't matter what your training is with autism when you're doing an assessment. It's really how you connect to people.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm sure that I would benefit from further training. I think we all do. But I feel very, very comfortable with children along this spectrum, and it doesn't matter to me if they fight and bite and whatever they want to do, that's fine with me. That's where they're starting from, and we need to know where they're at and then go from there.
Yeah. Okay, I just want to make a comment for the record that it was not my son biting. My son doesn't...
That's right. Jeremy's one of the most... See, it's easy for me to be gentle with Jeremy because he's such a gentle person himself, so
yes.
That's not a challenge.
No.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's a question from Eliza Horinsky-Beck, ODFCOVD, from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So she's also a doctor, I think. Isn't that what those letters mean?
That is, yeah. She's a fellow in the College of Optometrists and Vision Development.
Okay. So she would like to know, is there a document available for teachers that have kids on the spectrum in their regular classrooms to help incorporate vision and movement activities into classroom activities that could include the whole class? Do you have anything you could recommend?
In terms of classroom activities for children along the spectrum?
Yes, that might help with vision and movement. So in other words, there are activities that perhaps could be done in a classroom, but that would be fun for everyone to do?
Yeah, there are quite a few activities like that, and I collaborate often with the OTs that really know a lot about that type of thing. And I think I love working with occupational therapists that work with kids along the spectrum and their aides and everyone else that surrounds them, because they come up with some very novel, creative ideas that provide for lots of different things, social interaction, which enables there to be a sequential and spatial awareness of the events surrounding them. And I think that's the most important thing is have there be a spatial structure inside of which a sequential event is occurring. So, you know, it's hard for me to describe them over the phone, but even throwing a beanbag from one person to another when they're all standing on a balance board involves vestibular interaction, sequential awareness, and a spatial environment inside of which that sequential activity is occurring. So something as simple as that can be very important. Or having a ball hanging from a ceiling, and the ball has to be thrown from one person to another, and it's bound by the string hanging from the ceiling, so that it's not going to go flying around everywhere, but there's an opportunity for that ball to go everywhere, and it's random, but it's inside of a spatial organized system. So there's lots of things like that, and I don't know if there are any in particular written down, but there's lots of reference books that we might be able to work with, and I can communicate with Dr. Beck on that individually, too.
You know what? There's an idea for a book, Dr. Hillier.
Yeah. Group activities for kids that are in need of this kind of help. Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah, I think so. Okay, here's a question from, and I'm sorry if I'm going to massacre people's names, especially with the name I have. But this is from Shruti Kapoor in Suwanee, Georgia. My son is 5 now and was diagnosed with autism 2 years ago. I noticed I can't read some of the writing here because of the spelling, but eye tracking was poor.
Eye tracking.
Eye tracking. Okay, yeah, maybe that's what they wanted to say. Eye tracking was poor. Playing with blocks, copying patterns, building puzzles, where he has to look around for pieces, etc. he was showing impulsive behaviors in those when he was doing those things. In September, we got his vision checked, got him glasses, and started vision therapy now. He is reading at a grade one level, even though he is in pre-K and writes well, draws fine too. But when it comes to visual spatial relationships and playing gross motor games like with ball, we are not doing well at all. I need help in these areas. I'm confused at certain things he is good and not in others. Please, as a parent, please share any tools which I can incorporate in my daily life so as to help him.
Well, I think that one thing that might help him is what was mentioned was that he has difficulty with puzzles and blocks and putting things together such as that, and manipulatives, it sounds like. What I would recommend is to consider having him learn to categorize things on a very basic level. So maybe take have all squares be red, for example. All circles can be blue. All triangles are yellow. All diamonds are purple, or something like that. And have him learn to begin to categorize those manipulatives in different spatial locations on the carpet or on the table, and have that be the number one goal, is to be able to do that. And then what I would do is consider getting squares that are blue and red, and triangles that are yellow and green, and circles that are orange and red, for example. And then you start categorizing these in little subgroups. So let's put the orange, I can't remember the colors now, but let's put the orange squares here and the blue squares there. But first, let's put all the squares in a pile. So you get all the squares in the pile, and they're orange and blue, let's say. And now let's look at all those squares, and let's separate the squares from orange and blue. Now let's look at all the circles. They might be green and red. Let's put all the circles over there. But now look, there's some green circles and there's some red circles. Let's separate those. And then you start breaking these characteristics down into finer and finer differences. So I started out with just circles. Now we had red and green circles. Now you can have red circles that are thick and red circles that are thin. And you start separating those. And then you can have circles that are big and small, red and green, thick and thin. And these are called concept pieces. This comes out of an activity called concept pieces or attribute blocks. And you can get these blocks at educational supply stores. And when you start working with these real obvious features, such as color is the most obvious feature that kids typically sort by. So you sort by color. And then you can start sorting by shape. And then you start sorting by size. Then you start sorting by thickness. And it's a nice, steady progression. And if you're patient and you only introduce limited features in the beginning, just a few attributes such as two colors and then three colors, maybe four colors, and you start introducing these other elements very slowly, it becomes natural for him to be able to see the relationships amongst different shapes, different blocks, different colors. And then when you start getting involved with more complicated puzzles and patterns and things of that nature, it becomes more accessible to him, and it won't be something that he rejects and gets frustrated with. That's one approach to that.
Okay, that's very useful. That should keep them busy for a little while.
Yeah, that activity that I just described might take months to from beginning to end. That would be a 4 to 6 month sequence of events in a vision therapy office, for example. Now, if you don't have training with that activity, it's challenging to do. But if you have some background in some of the Piagetian developmental concepts, and as a therapist might have, then I think it would be something you might be able to do on your own. Otherwise, you might want to consult with somebody that does that type of developmental cognitive work.
Okay. Here's one from Leclerc in Houston, Texas. My son is telling me the sun is hurting my eyes. So his son or her son says, my son, the sun is hurting my eyes. What is the problem?
Okay.
Is that just needing sunglasses?
Well, it might be, but there's lots of reason. The medical term for that is called photophobia. And this is caused by lots of different things. And I'll give you the three most common things right now. One is the eyes are intermittently out of alignment, meaning when light hits the eyes, it disrupts them to a sufficient degree to cause the eyes to drift out of alignment, thus causing confusion in the visual environment and therefore squinting and avoidance of light because it causes confusion. So that would be one thing. It's a binocular dysfunction. Another thing that causes this photophobia is uncorrected refractive conditions, especially astigmatism. So there might be astigmatism such that when light enters the eye, the light's focused in all different areas of the eye, causing a scatter. And that causes light to be just too overwhelming to contend with. And then the third most common reason, actually this ties, I'm going to give you a fourth reason, but the third reason is where there's little tiny opacities in the what we call the optical media of the eye. And so under a microscope, you can look into the eye and see whether or not there are little tiny particles that scatter the light when the light hits the eye. And under dim conditions, it's not so bad. But when there's a bright light or when it's a bright sunny day, the light enters the eye and scatters all over the place. It makes it very difficult for any one of us to see under those conditions. And these are called little opacities in the optical media. And they can be identified and looked for. And so sometimes the fourth thing that I was going to mention was particles in the tear film or a dry eye situation, which is kind of rare with children. But if it's a windy day, if there's a lot of ultraviolet light out there, or there's dust in the environment, it can contribute to this sensation of photophobia or the bright lights bothering them. So the solution kind of depends on the cause. And oftentimes it might mean a pair of nice quality Polaroid sunglasses. And what I mean by good quality is that it cuts out the ultraviolet light, and the Polaroid nature of it helps eliminate scattered light. So sometimes that's the solution. But other times it might just be nutritional health to improve the tear layer and to improve the functioning of the eye in general. So many of us have heard of omega-3 acids and these types of things, which are very, very, very helpful in terms of not only maintaining eye health, but also brain health from a nutritional standpoint.
Very good. Lori Richmond from Mecosta, Missouri, wrote in to say to please tell the mom in Florida that it's important to have the proper insurance codes so that it's billed as a medical and not as a vision.
That's correct. I mean, we're talking about a major medical condition here. This is all that we're talking about here in terms of binocular dysfunctions and things of this nature. These are major medical issues that have major medical codes associated with them, and they also have major medical procedure codes. So there's major medical diagnostic codes, there's major medical procedure codes, but I wouldn't necessarily always count on insurance companies being able to take care of your children. Unfortunately, they sometimes don't always, the administration of these insurance companies sometimes don't always follow the needs of what's important. So, but yes, the woman in Florida, I think, is correct in saying that you have to have the right procedure codes for the right diagnostic codes.
There's someone asking, Corina Shelley, OD from Tracy, Canada. Dr. Hilliard, thank you for giving this webinar. What's the best way for an OD to get into the schools to test students with IEPs? California, by the way. Sorry.
I'm sorry. What was that last part?
I'm thinking they're from California, not Canada, because it's CA, but I'm thinking about the Olympics so much that I...
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, well, I don't go into the schools to screen children that have IEPs, and I think that would be very, very challenging to do just from an administrative, even political perspective, because these children with IEPs already have an established academic plan to fulfill the educational needs of that child. But within an individual IEP of an individual child, I think that's where you're going to provide some help. And so the individual child that has an IEP that comes into your office, you are by definition part of that IEP team now, because you're a treating clinician of that child that has come into your office that has an IEP. So you can then make recommendations to the IEP team in the form of a written report that has objective data describing their visual preparedness for learning. And if this objective data contributes to a lack of ability to learn in the academic environment, then by its nature, the IEP team should consider that as something to remove as a blockage and provide treatment to resolve the issue. So I think that it really has to, I don't think you can just go into a school, at least I'm not aware of how one would do that, and screen everyone that has an IEP, but rather you have to do it on an individualized basis. And many times it would involve you actually being at the IEP meeting, at the each individual IEP meeting, to share with the group what the rationale is behind your proposed treatment. Because remember, the vast majority of people, even academicians and administrators, still feel that perfect vision is 20/20, which is one of the most cruel statements a parent can hear, and certainly that a child experiences, because there's so much more to vision than 20/20, as you well know.
Okay. Dr. Cody Bengoa, FCOVD, from Winnemucca, Nevada. You mentioned tracking tubes. What other vision therapy activities do you like to use with autistic patients who do not write or recognize words or letters or seem to respond to yoked prisms?
Well, I first want to cause that or create arrange conditions for the child to be engaged in the physical environment. So if yoked prisms don't do it, then I will get them, first of all, on a balance board or a walking rail to cause them to have to deal with gravity. And I think dealing with gravity is an essential part of waking up the midbrain to cause both hemispheres to pay attention to the environment around them. And I don't want to go overboard with that, because that can be overwhelming to the individual and it can shut them down. So you have to be careful about that. Putting them on a trampoline but not having them jump, for example, would be maybe one way to at least open it up. And then I would just play catch with a beanbag with them to initiate reciprocity in terms of interacting with them, to let them know that it's safe, to let them know that it's fun, that they can be successful, that they in fact have something to do about the environment around them, and their actions actually result in a reaction. And this kind of interaction then can dovetail into other activities, such as a labarge, a piece of equipment that is usually available, and it's a keyboard. It's kind of like a 8x8 array of buttons that they can push in sequence. Pegboards are often very helpful. Chalkboard circles that are guided by the therapist to enable them to do bilateral chalkboard circles. An AccuVision type of instrument, or saccadic fixator type of instrument, is also very helpful usually. So that's usually how I get them going. I will work with parquetry blocks, a feel box. A variety of activities that surround the matrix activity are often helpful.
I'm amazed by the amounts of things you have in your office. And also, I have to tell everybody that I think that on the weekends, Dr. Hillier experiments in the garage, because he comes up with all kinds of things, and he's very generous with giving them to his patients.
Well, there's a seminar that Dr. Robert Sanett gives throughout the country that's a five-weekend, three-day-each-weekend program on how to do these kinds of things, these types of activities with various patients. And that might be something to look into, Robert Sanett's seminars.
Okay. Here's a question from Linda in Mount Laurel, New Jersey. My son has what we believe are visual stims. He likes to throw things up in the air to watch them drop, bounce, etc., and jumps up and down clapping as it is happening, or likes to drop tissues from high up to watch them float down to the ground and gets just as excited. Could any type of visual therapy help with this, or is this just something he may outgrow?
Well, that's a good question. Your son's doing that for a reason, first of all. So we, you know, I think that has to be, from my perspective, the first thing that's understood. He's doing that for a reason, and he's getting pleasure from that, okay? But that's certainly not, if he continues to do that singular activity, he's not going to be able to develop into more, into obviously more other functional activities such as handwriting or whatever else you might want him to be doing. But sometimes those are breaks. So with some individuals, you let them go and they'll do that all day long. With others, they're doing that just as a break until they are encouraged to do something else. So if he's just doing that for a little bit and he easily breaks away from it, I wouldn't worry about it too much because we all take breaks from doing things now and again, and that might just be his break. But yes, vision therapy can modify that behavior because we slowly introduce other activities that might surround that behavior. So if he's throwing up a tissue and watching it hit the ground, what we try to do is have him throw it up and have it land in a certain area. So it's goal-directed instead of just random. You said he was throwing something else up in the air and having it come down too. What was that, Chantel?
Kleenex.
Kleenex and something else?
Just balls and...
Balls. Okay. Well, substitute the ball for a bean bag, and when he throws it up, if he gets it in a big pan, then you give it to him again, and he can do it some more. If he doesn't get it in the pan, you take it away, and we move on to something else. So, this is behavior modification in a sense, but it's surrounding a visual activity that's now goal-oriented, and we do slowly drift away from the just pure stimming activity to having it be goal-oriented. So in terms of vision therapy, we would have him do that when he's standing on a balance board or a trampoline, because then all of a sudden he's getting this vestibular input, which obligates his peripheral vision to be more intact or more available to him. When that peripheral visual system is more available to him, he then starts to realize there's a bigger space around him that he has an opportunity to interact with. So usually when getting him involved with a vestibular activity as he's stimming would open up periphery to then enable him to see that there's alternatives to his behavior. There's other things that can be done. And we would slowly move and expand. In this particular example I'm talking about, if he's throwing the beanbag up and watching it hit the ground, he can continue to do that so long as the beanbag hits a certain target. If it doesn't, you actually physically move him away and we're doing something else now.
Okay. Ready for another question?
Sure.
Randy Invernal says, I'm not sure how to ask this question, but I have a 9-year-old daughter on the spectrum with severe ROP, retinopathy of prematurity. She recently lost the use of her left eye and is now left with only her right, having no peripheral vision and seeing up to 20 feet. School is now an enormous challenge. Not sure what to do addressing vision issues before attention ASD issues, or is there any suggestions as to how best to attack the situation? She's learning Braille and cane mobility usage, so bases are covered there. But with the multiple diagnosis of ROP and ASD, we are hitting brick walls everywhere. Any therapies or little tricks we can use to help with schoolwork? Or is there something that we should be asking for in particular?
Well, that's a real tough situation, obviously. And number one, just protect the left eye from injury, okay, because blunt injury can cause that situation to worsen. So she should be wearing glasses, even if she doesn't need glasses to see clearly. In my opinion, she probably should wear glasses of some kind to just protect her eye from accidental blunt injury. And certainly not be in environmental situations that might cause injury to the eye,
Right.
Okay, so that is the first step, of course. The second step is to, you mentioned that there was not much peripheral vision available to her, but therefore only central vision available to her. And the comment about seeing only 20 feet, If that means that she can only see clearly 20 feet away, then I think lenses themselves might extend that range. I don't know how old the child is.
9 years old.
Nine years old?
Yeah.
Okay. So I think depending on where the issue is and what her level of visual acuity is, you're going to want to use, I still think that developing the ability to understand visual space as best as you can, I would have her with her vision as optimized as best she can. With I would walk her around high contrast environments and have her know the distance between things when she's walking and see them change size as she approaches them. Now, I'm talking about a therapeutic level now, and I'll talk about some compensatory things later. But first of all, safety, okay? Don't injure the left eye. And the second thing is, let's do some therapies to enhance her ability to understand space and time. Because as she's walking through an environment that has high contrast visual targets available to her, so I'm envisioning I'm looking at my doorway right here, and if it were just painted black, the door jamb, I would see this big black vertical rectangle. And as I approached it, that rectangle would get bigger and bigger and bigger. And as I would approach it, I would know that I'm traveling through a certain amount of space and I'm getting nearer to something and it's getting bigger. And that's helping me recognize when and where I am in my environment. So depending on how much visual difficulty she has, you want to engage her in this dynamic three-dimensional experience as much as she can with the vision that she has. And I think that's going to be real supportive in her feeling secure and confident in the space around her if she were to ever lose more vision. So even when you've lost vision, if you have this previous experience of moving through space with vision, that will support you if she were to eventually lose vision in the other eye. So that would be the first thing. The second thing in terms of therapeutics would be to see a doctor of optometry who specializes in low vision. So this area of specialty called low vision is what optometrists specialize in, and they might be able to provide a certain tint, a certain magnifying lens, a certain prism of some kind to maximize her visual contact with the environment around her. So in terms of compensatory things now, I know that she's learning Braille, and that's fine, but I also think that she, again, I don't know too much about her visual skills other than what you've told me, but I wouldn't give up on written language. I wouldn't capitalize on it necessarily, depending, again, on what she can, in fact, see. So, for example, if she can see 2100, she should still learn to read. If possible. If she can only see 2200, maybe not, depending on the optical aids that are available to her. But books on tape, obviously, would be something to think about as well in terms of compensatory actions. You said she's learning how to use a cane. I think that's fine, but obviously, for her to be as independent as possible and being able to use that cane, and I'm not a mobility therapist, but I know that those that work with mobility training are excellent in that area. But again, high contrast, black and white kinds of information, high color contrast information. I don't know if she can use a computer, but there are all variety of computer programs that magnify, of course, and this would be, you know, a visual impaired teacher and can help also with, you know, getting all the hardware available necessary for her. And I'm sure that she's already engaged with those services already, but I don't know if I addressed the question completely or not.
Well, I think it was helpful. If she's listening, she can always send another question.
Okay.
I'll check to see if she does.
Okay.
Maureen Lizak in Detroit. My son is 8 and has Asperger's. I noticed in school and during homework, he rubs his eyes a lot. Also, when he reads aloud, he skips words. Any idea why he could be doing this?
Well, rubbing the eyes is usually, if it's a visual issue, which usually is because he's rubbing his eyes, is because of a lack of focusing skill or a lack of binocular skill. Now, sometimes, if you get good at it, when you watch your child read, and this is especially important for very, very young children, for adults to look at, but for older children, you can sometimes see it as well. It is difficult, but I'm going to share it with you anyway. But when you look at a child read and their pupil, you look at their pupils should get smaller when they look close up. Now, if they don't seem to get smaller when they look close up, that's likely that they're having real difficulty focusing. And if they're having difficulty focusing, they're either going to avoid close work, they're going to rub their eyes, or they're going to take forever to do something that shouldn't take so long. So focusing difficulty is one thing, and sometimes you can detect that by looking at their pupils not getting smaller when they're doing close work. So big pupils when they're looking close up is kind of a sign that maybe something's going on. The other thing that could be difficult for this boy is eye teaming. So that's another reason why children rub their eyes, because their eyes don't line up just right. And they're holding the book too close or holding the book too far. The other thing, though, that you can, in terms of rubbing the eyes, and I think every parent should do this, and it's critically important, and I'm glad this question came up, and that is to put a little mirror, like a cosmetic mirror, on the surface of the material that your child's looking at. And this should be done at school. It should be done at home. And when they're sitting at the table or they're reading a book or wherever they are, and you're expecting them to have good visual attention for what they're looking at, what I strongly recommend that you do is take a little cosmetic mirror, put it on the surface of the material they're looking at, and make sure that your child's face doesn't light up from the reflection of that mirror because of the light that they're using. And what I mean by this is whatever light they're using to read by, it can reflect right into their face off the surface of their page. And you can see it very clearly when you put the mirror there, because the mirror then reflects it directly into their face, and you can see their face light up. Well, this is a common issue with children who have difficulty with sustained attention for reading and who have these symptoms such as rubbing the eyes and avoiding reading and being uncomfortable and not being able to read very, very long, because the light's shining right in their face. Just like if you were trying to read a book and somebody was shining a flashlight in your face, that'd be very irritating. Well, this is what it's like when light's reflecting into the face. So anyway, for rubbing the eyes, check the lighting, the reflection of the light, see if they're focusing well, and maybe ask your child, do you ever see two of something when you know there's really only one? This means that their eyes aren't lining up very effectively, and that's why they're rubbing their eyes. So ask them, do you ever see two of something when you know there's really only one? Now, the other question was, why might they be skipping words when reading? And that is frequently because they don't have the muscular skill to move their eyes when and where they want to in order to scan along the line of print. There's these six muscles that surround each eye, and they're under our voluntary control, just like the muscles in your fingers. And they're learned skills. It's a learned skill to move your eyes across. It's an ability. It's not an innate automatic process that we have to be able to scan exactly when and where we need to along a line of print in order to capture all the words that are there in that text. So they probably haven't learned how to develop those discrete eye movements that are critical for being able to see every word along the line of print. And fortunately, that's a relatively easy skill to acquire through vision therapy.
Very good. Shirley in Arlington would like to have her question answered. We took our daughter to a pediatric ophthalmologist who we were referred to that checks on convergence insufficiency, and was told that she didn't have that but possibly had eye strain and recommended over-the-counter reading glasses. I wondered about a second opinion. Also, should we ask for tests for any other eye issues that they wouldn't check for unless asked to?
Well, that's a difficult question. Of course, if the ophthalmologist did not identify a convergence insufficiency, it probably wasn't there. They're trained to do that. They do tend to look for more gross expressions of convergence insufficiency. I mean, there is a specific objective diagnostic criterion that you must fulfill in order to have convergence insufficiency. But there are lots of binocular dysfunctions that are just as devastating as convergence insufficiency that this child might have, resulting in eye strain. And if there is eye strain, then this clinician-recommended over-the-counter reading glasses. Now, it suggests that the child just needs, you know, a simple kind of not very refined prescription. The reason I'm hesitating is because most individuals need a very specific prescription that's derived by very specific testing. And the reading glasses that are made available over the counter at drugstores, you know, that you've seen everywhere, the optical center of those lenses are typically designed for adults, an average adult. And if you look through, if you don't look through the optical center of these lenses, then you're obligated to either overconverge your eyes or underconverge your eyes in order to keep from seeing double. And so if you ask a child to pick up a pair of these over-the-counter glasses, and hopefully a very specific power was suggested, but rather not letting the parent just decide which ones to pick. But regardless of that, if you're looking through glasses that are designed for an adult, you're by definition asking that child to excessively converge because the optics of the eyes are too far apart for an adult, I mean for a child. And the child has to look through the middle part of the lens, obligating them to converge their eyes extra hard, which I think might add to the strain. But those lens powers are often too strong for children anyway, in my opinion. So it may have been one in a lot of kids that he found would benefit from this particular lens, and I just don't like the over-the-counter lenses because they aren't fabricated with the optical precision that's really required to really provide what's necessary for any, actually, in my opinion, any one of us, because of the incredible amount of precision that the eyes need to have when they're focusing for reading, let alone just the development of your child's brain. I just never do that kind of thing. Yeah.
Even for us older people who need nearsighted glasses?
No, because your visual systems are too important to just pick a lens off the rack and not have lenses directly put in front of the optical alignment of each eye, because most of us have jobs that require a lot of visual precision and endurance. And so why sacrifice efficiency and endurance and comfort for the amount of for that kind of lens power that's available off the rack? I mean, your eyes are very, very finely tuned instruments that want a very refined solution to the demands of that individual, whether it be a computer at a certain distance or reading at a certain distance or a mechanic or whatever you might be doing. Different powers are important for different people, and the optical center, that centering of the lens, is absolutely critical. Now, you can get by with over-the-counter lenses, no doubt about it, but are you wearing the optimal lens for most efficiency? Probably not.
Well said. Here's a question from Tracy Riff in Chula Vista, California. Is there some sort of checklist that we can take with us to our optometrist to make sure they are checking what they need to be looking at for our autistic child?
Great question, and yes, there is. And if you go to pavevision.org, that's the Parents Active for Vision Education.org website, they have a symptom checklist. COVD, the College of Optometrists and Vision Development, also has a vision symptom checklist that you can get, because that's absolutely critical. And again, I would interview the offices before you go and ask the receptionist, you know, does the doctor work with children along the autistic spectrum? And if the receptionist doesn't really know, you might not be in the right place. So, you know, a simple interview like that would be helpful. And, but the checklists available through PAVE and through COVD.org are great.
Good.
Yeah.
Here's a question from Nidhi Bhatnagar in New Delhi. Sir, my child has started recently rubbing his eyes frequently and non-purposefully. Also, he has started making strange faces. He has difficulty in chewing also. Please guide me what can be done best. So rubbing the eyes frequently and non-purposefully, and also making strange faces.
And
I don't know if that's related to the eyesight, and I don't know how old he is.
Okay, and chewing differences?
Difficulty in chewing.
Okay. It sounds like it would be a good idea to consider a pediatric neurologist just to make sure that there's no underlying neurological issue going on with the face, the facial muscles. There might be a spasm of some of the muscles surrounding the eyes, the jaw, and you know, the twitching or making strange faces. Sometimes this is induced by an underlying cranial nerve issue, what's called the facial nerve. And so you just want to make sure that there's nothing going on that's new, that's driving this from a neurological basis. So you just want to make sure that the underlying neurology is intact and everything's okay there. So a pediatric neurologist might be a good one to go to just to make sure that everything's okay in that area. But what I've also noticed, if you had just said squinting and rubbing the eyes non-purposefully, and you didn't mention these other things, I would have asked the question, does your child play a lot of handheld video games? Because what's happening now is that more and more children are playing handheld video games for long periods of time, and their visual systems are very, very young to be able to have to do this. They're physiologically really not prepared to do such things. And the eyes and the facial muscles around the eyes often go into a cramp. And children will blink in these very unusual, dramatic ways, which oftentimes can lead to, you know, these facial twitches and blurred vision and blinking in strange ways. And this is often and very frequently due to excessive near-point visual stress secondary to this prolonged, culturally induced drive to spend time on these handheld video games. And it happens at least 90% of the time when children come in with these kinds of symptoms, and I ask the question, are you playing video games? And, you know, the child kind of squeamishly says yes, and the parents look at them and say yes, and they're playing a lot. And then when we have them stop playing video games for a couple of weeks, these symptoms go away. So that's something to look at. But first of all, just make sure that your child's doing okay from a medical standpoint, and then ask the question, are they spending a lot of time with video games?
Interesting. Okay, here's Lynn from Lynn, Massachusetts. Are you a proponent of visual hygiene lists?
Visual hygiene lists?
Yes.
Absolutely. What I mean by visual hygiene is not like dental hygiene, but it's hard to come up with a word that really describes this. What I mean by visual hygiene is arranging your visual environment so that your visual system is in the least amount of stress and is in the most efficient situation for optimal information processing. And so what I mean by that is for children at school, I mentioned part of it, and that is to make sure that the lighting is optimal. So if you're a right-handed individual and you're doing a lot of handwriting with a pencil, you do not want a shadow cast across the surface of the paper that you're writing on. So, for example, you wouldn't want the light in front of you, but you'd want it over your non-dominant shoulder. So if I'm a right-handed individual and I'm writing at my desk, I would like the equivalent of about a 100-watt incandescent or halogen bulb beyond my left shoulder, so there's no shadows on the paper that I'm writing, and there's no reflected light bouncing back into my face. Part of visual hygiene is lighting. So I prefer incandescent light. I prefer that people go to a warehouse store and buy the 5 different kinds of incandescent lights that are available: warm white, cool white, soft light, daylight, all these different kinds of light bulbs. Buy a 50-watt bulb, a 75-watt bulb, a 100-watt bulb, a 150-watt bulb. Find out what volume of light you like, what color of light you like, and live in that light, because you're going to feel more comfortable, you're going to be more efficient, and make sure that it doesn't reflect into your face. And typically, fluorescent lighting is not one of the lighting styles that benefit people. So lighting is part of visual hygiene. The other part of visual hygiene is to read from a sloped surface. If you simply slope your reading material up 20 or 22 degrees, it's been shown that that's more efficient in lots of different levels, not only visually, but from a somatosensory standpoint as well. So the structure of your body is actually in a position that allows more blood flow to go into your brain, more oxygen to go into your brain, because your body's upright. It's not constricted. So there's much more natural flow of nutrients into your brain for thinking about what your eyes are looking at. And a 20-degree slope is a natural down gaze for the eyes to look at. Another part of visual hygiene is not getting too close to the written material. So the traditional, the physiologically adopted distance is an elbow on the page and your knuckles under your chin. So it's a good idea to not let children or any one of us to get closer than the distance of your elbow on the page to your knuckles under your chin. So those three aspects of visual hygiene are very, very important. And if we were just all to adopt those, if industry were to adopt those, they would find that everyone would be a lot more productive. Students would be a lot more productive. There would be a lot less stress after school. Children wouldn't be so exhausted after school, typically. People wouldn't be so exhausted after work if they would just follow these general guidelines. On a computer, and I want to mention this just briefly, is that you should probably be arm's reach from a computer. A computer typically should be a little bit down gaze, if you can, instead of it straight ahead of you, a little bit down. Try not to wear light clothing that would reflect off the surface of the screen. Try not to sit behind a bright window or light, because that would reflect off the screen. And have there be an opportunity to look off into three-dimensional space after having looked close up for a long period of time. I would recommend every 15 or 20 minutes just look away, stand up, stretch, and after about 30 seconds come back and sit down and resume your activity.
It's really funny because I'm sitting here in front of my computer screen analyzing everything you've just said, and I think I'm doing pretty good.
Good. Yeah, I mean, literally a 30-second breather, stand up, stretch, twist, take a deep breath, sit down again, you're going to feel rejuvenated and ready to go, unlike sitting through an hour's worth of close work. It's just not appropriate physiologically for kids to sit still that long anyway. They need to be moving around, yeah.
Brandy, that is the person, the mother who had the child who had lost the sight in one eye.
Yes.
And just confirming that when she talked about the 20 feet vision, it was 20 feet maximum vision with correction.
Okay. My question would be, that, and I don't mean just to have this be just a conversation between me and Brandy's mom, but the question I then would have is, you mean, can she see clearly 20 feet away, and beyond 20 feet it gets blurry, or can things be clear further than 20 feet, but they're just too small to see? So these kind of questions are important. And so she doesn't have the functional capacity to see beyond 20 feet, maybe, but does she have, maybe with a telescope, could she see beyond 20 feet? And this is when it comes into the low vision side of things, like an optometrist that specializes in low vision can possibly assist Brandy in being able to see beyond 20 feet functionally, such as in a classroom, or watching a movie or watching TV, things like that. But yes, so I suspect that she can see functionally inside of 20 feet. She definitely needs to have that mobility to feel confident in knowing what's beyond 20 feet when she approaches it, or if she has to move beyond 20 feet, what can she glean or understand about the space beyond 20 feet? And that's probably something that she could acquire. So I see a lot of low vision patients. I see a lot of patients that only have one eye or that can't see better than 20/200 because they need to use their visual systems as best they can. So they come into vision therapy not because they might acquire better visual acuity or better peripheral vision, but they come into vision therapy like an athlete would come into vision therapy to maximize their visual abilities in whatever activities they're engaging in. So this can be done through vision therapy as well, in conjunction with her mobility trainer and her visual specialist at the school.
Okay, I have a question for you because I don't know the answer to this, even though it has to do with Jeremy. I hope you remember.
Okay.
Ann, COVT, from Bloomington. Did Jeremy use yoked prism base up or down, right, or left?
Jeremy is actually using base left yoke prism, and so it's causing a lateral shift.
Okay.
Yeah, and this is because Jeremy has what we call a left visual midline shift. Now, I couldn't ask Jeremy where he perceives things relative to the middle of his body, so I just had to observe his behavior. And as we know, Jeremy leads with his left foot. He puts his left foot forward, and he likes to stim with toys on his left side, and he will rock that way a lot. And so I assume that he had this midline shift to the side. And we explored different prisms, and we came up with the ones that we did.
Yeah, we could see a noticeable difference. And he actually said it was the first time that he could see the lines and the corners that made the walls, like he could see where the walls were.
Yeah, yeah. And he sees the boundaries of the space that he's inside of, thus enabling to be more secure, more organized,
right,
and being able to then think about the structure of the proximal space that he's in. Once you establish a knowledge or safety or confidence in the distal space, the extrapersonal space, then you can start dealing with the interpersonal space and the structure of things that you can manipulate and be involved in close space.
Right. This is what Jeremy had to say about the prisms and the tints. I have to say the prisms are helpful for my guidance through indoor spaces, but they are mightily enhanced by the addition of a yellow tint. Looking through lenses has greatly helped me with my perception of where I am in spaces. The yellow makes me see greatly the relationship between objects. And this is really interesting. Jeremy has an assistance dog that he wanted for the longest time. And so he talks about, before glasses, I saw my dog handsome as a ball of fur. With the prisms, I could see a tail and four legs. With the yellow lenses and the prisms, I very much see the great depth of my dog. I see the dimensions. I mean that he looks like he has more to him than just fur. He is visible as a very real and beautiful creature, not just as a blob.
Wonderful. Yeah, that is so wonderful that he can articulate that. And I think that when children, or adults for that matter, have an opportunity to try these prisms, you know, many times they can't articulate it like Jeremy can.
Uh-huh.
But you can see it in their behavior. You can
uh-huh.
see them have a kind of a hop in their step, a confidence, a joy in their movement that's different than before. And it's wonderful to see. Yeah.
It is. Okay, now Deborah Miller in Versailles, Kentucky asks, have you ever used low plus with a 4 or an 8 base up or base down during therapy with broad spectrum of therapy patients? We have had a lot of progress with this.
We do use a lot of low plus and subtle amounts of prism. I usually don't go that low, though. I will usually usually don't go to an 8th in therapy. Sometimes I'll prescribe it, but I usually in therapy I will try to jolt them a little bit, not beyond their comfort zone or what they feel safe with, but I want to cause a little bit of a disruption to see how they handle it, and then but not so much so that, like I said, that it causes them fear, but enables them to integrate something new. So I haven't gone to the 8th power prism, but I will use quite a bit of low plus, like you described. Yeah.
And Bridget from upstate New York would like to know, what type of lenses are best to help a child to descend stairs with alternating feet?
You know, it's interesting that I used to think that it was going to be either base up or base down, but that's not always the case. The difficulty I have been finding with alternating feet is a lot of individuals will put a lot of weight on one foot compared to the other. And, by the way, this is kind of true with Jeremy. And so you can't alternate very effectively when you always want to put more weight on one side of your body than the other. But so in the beginning I was thinking, well, that's got to be vertical yoke prism. But what I'm finding is that lateral yoke prism creates this balance, you know, of the midline back to center, thus enabling the freedom to move both legs off the ground more readily, enabling there to be an alternating sequence of moving up the stairs. So I think that might answer your question in regards to the yoke prism, but I'm finding that it's not always just lateral. It can be whatever enables that individual to feel confident in space, and it can be any direction.
Hey, Marcy from Skokie, Illinois. Do you recommend keeping mirror point materials at an arm's distance? If yes, why can't the student get closer if it helps him see clear her and he's more comfortable?
Well, I don't recommend that they look at reading material at arm's distance, but rather the distance from the elbow on the page to the knuckles under their chin, which is a little closer, thus enabling the hands to manipulate the material that they're looking at. And I think that's important. When the hands can actually touch the material that they're looking at, the eyes more naturally and reflexively engage in that material. The body wants to look at, or the eyes want to look at what the body is manipulating. So not at arm's reach, but inside of arm's reach a little bit. Now, bringing things closer does not necessarily enable individuals to see things clearer, to focus more easily. Sometimes bringing things closer is more difficult for individuals to see, especially those with a condition called convergence insufficiency, which was mentioned earlier, or that's a specific kind of eye alignment or binocular difficulty. But also, sometimes kids don't want to bring things closer because it's just too hard to make things clear. Although images get bigger, they're blurrier and they're harder to sustain the clarity. So sometimes bringing it closer is not necessarily a good thing.
Here's a question from Beverly Del Greco from Long Island, New York. My son has exotropia.
Uh-huh.
How do you say that?
Exotropia,
short-sightedness, and tracking problems. I went to a doctor who does vision therapy and is on the COVD.org list. She prescribed glasses and not vision therapy, but she said she didn't think we should do vision therapy. He was not cooperative in the chair. Should I get a second opinion?
Yeah, I think it's always good to get a second opinion. I recommend my patients get a second opinion sometimes if I sense they're not real secure with what I'm suggesting. And it's not offensive to the examining clinician. I think we want our patients to feel comfortable with the decisions that we make, and so that shouldn't be a problem. An individual, the exotropia means that the eyes are pointed outward and they're out of alignment. And depending on the goal of therapy, if the goal of vision therapy is to straighten the eyes so they're cosmetically aligned and functionally aligned, this is routinely achieved in vision therapy, except under certain conditions. There are certain conditions that make vision therapy not appropriate, and this would be if there's a risk for what we call intractable diplopia. Now, so if this doctor of optometry, the fellow that was mentioned, felt that there was a risk of that, then maybe that's why vision therapy wasn't recommended. So I really can't comment further than that because I don't know the circumstances necessarily underlying the condition. But an active child that can't sit in a chair is not something that prevents anyone from doing vision therapy. So it might have been another reason. I'm not sure.
Okay. Here's Jennifer from Orlando, Florida. And we'll probably have one more question after this one. But Jennifer in Orlando, here's her question. For the past 2 months, my son has been complaining of vision loss, explaining vision is blurring and going black. Each episode happens for no more than 30 to 45 seconds. This happens in all activities from reading to playing. He recently had a physical eye exam in which no issues were noted. I'm curious as to knowing if visual convergence issues could exhibit this sort of visual loss activity.
Does it say how old the child is?
No, it does not.
Okay. What's being described is either real serious or functionally serious, I could say. So it's either physiologically serious or maybe functionally serious. What I mean by functionally serious is that it may really affect her academic development. What I mean by medically serious is that, gosh, if she's having these blackouts of her visual environment, then it could mean a lack of blood flow into the brain, almost like a fainting spell, you know. And so what's causing her to faint? Could it be hypotension, postural hypotension? Could it be stress? Could it be a number of other physiological conditions? So I think, although, you know, remember that most visual examinations determine whether or not an individual sees 20/20 and if the eyes are healthy. Now, if that's the type of examination she had, I think you need to get another one that's more appropriate for your child's symptoms. But having her pediatrician check this out as well, I think, is also indicated to make sure there's not some underlying physiological condition that's causing her to have these visual blackouts. But having said all that, if it's a functional issue, which often occurs with girls, actually, around 10 to 13, 14 years old, it's called Streff syndrome, S-T-R-E-F-F. And it's a visual stress condition whereby there's a lot of visual demand on the system, there's a lot of cultural expectation for academic success, and there's an internal demand to perform well by the individual. And these symptoms that you're mentioning of the intermittent blur, kind of blacking out, visual acuity being degraded, yet there's no apparent refractive condition to explain it, suggests that she might be under a lot of visual stress. And if she is under a lot of visual stress, then oftentimes what we call low plus stress relieving lenses can be very effective, especially in conjunction with vision therapy, to help relax the system, to develop better skills of focusing, to relieve the visual interference that's causing these symptoms to arise.
Very good. That's about all the time that we have. Gosh, I wish I could have you on for 8 more hours because there's questions left and because there's so much that we've learned. And I've actually, I wish that I had heard about vision therapy or met you many more years ago, perhaps when I first moved to San Diego. I think Jeremy would have been better off then, but better late than never, right?
Right, and I think he's going to do fine. He'll be able to just do fine, no problem. Yeah.
Well, I say that to encourage people. Don't think it's ever too late for your child because the window of opportunity never closes. And isn't that right, Dr. Hillier?
That's right. I mean, there's no age. There used to be thought that there was an age beyond which you couldn't engage in these clinical interventions, and it's been shown over and over and over again in the popular literature and the scientific literature that this just truly isn't the case. So there's really not an age or a limit beyond which you can't derive some benefit from these interventions.
Great. Well, Dr. Hillier, did you want to mention your website and also any other website for information that people may want to refer to?
Well, I think the major ones are the COVD website, covd.org, or covd.org, is a very good bookmark. And or I have it under one of my bookmarks. But it's that's probably the most basic one for all that you might want in regards to getting the scientific literature available surrounding vision therapy. My website is San Diego Center for Vision Care.com, and it's a work in progress. So when you get there, I guess I'm a bit embarrassed to mention it, but it's a good website. It does have information. It has lots of buttons you can push to go to other websites as well for all variety of information. There's an audio file on there that you can listen to me and other parents talk about how we coordinate vision therapy. It's important for parents to be involved in the vision therapy process. So there's about a 45-minute audio file there that you can listen to me and another parent talking about the critical relationship of how we work with kids and how important it is in the ways that we communicate with them. That might be interesting to your listeners as well. So that's the San Diego Center for Vision Care.com. And then the final website would be pavevision.org.
Thank you so much, Dr. Hillier, for being our guest this evening.
You're welcome. I appreciate the opportunity, and I hope to be able to help anyone that has any questions through my website or through my email.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And for those who are listening who would like to give feedback on tonight's webinar, please call 877 877-211-0212 and then press the number 1. Again, that's 877-211-0212 and press the number 1. Thank you again for listening in to this webinar brought to you by MomsFightingAutism.com. And until next time, be the change that you want to see.